Joe, how you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you, sir?
Very, very well, thank you. Well, this week we agreed to talk about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. There are a couple of movies one has come out, a documentary called RBG, and of course, biopic that's due out later this year called On the Basis of Sex, about the crusading and heroic Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I thought tonight we'd apply the culture critique to her career and her life. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, born Joan Ruth Bader, March 15th, the Ides of March, beware of the Ides of March, 1933, is an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. This is all according to Wikipedia, of course. Ginsburg was appointed by President Bill Clinton and took the oath of office on August 10th, 1993. She is the second female justice after Sandra Day O'Connor of four to be confirmed to the court, along with Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, who are still serving. She's generally viewed as belonging to the liberal wing of the court. Ginsburg has authored notable majority opinions. She earned her bachelor's degree at Cornell University and was a wife and mother before starting law school at Harvard, where she was one of the few women in her class. Ginsburg transferred to Columbia Law School, where she graduated tied for first in her class. Following law school, Ginsburg turned to academia. She was a professor at Rutgers School of Law and Columbia Law School, teaching civil procedure as one of the few women in her field. Ginsburg spent a considerable part of her legal career as an advocate for the advancement of gender equality and women's rights. Winning multiple victories, arguing before the Supreme Court, she advocated as a volunteer lawyer for the American Civil Liberties Union and was a member of its board of directors and one of its general counsels in the 1970s. In 1980, President Jimmy Carter appointed her to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, where she served until appointment to the Supreme Court in 1993. In the fall of 1956, Ginsburg enrolled at Harvard Law School, where she was one of only nine women in the class of about 500 men. The dean of Harvard Law reportedly asked the female law students, including Ginsburg, "How do you justify taking a spot from a qualified man?" When her husband took a job in New York, Ginsburg transferred to Columbia Law School and became the first woman to be on two major law reviews, the Harvard Law Review and the Columbia Law Review. In 1959, she earned her Juris Doctor at Columbia and tied for first in her class. In 1960, Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter rejected Ginsburg for a clerkship position due to her gender. Remember, it's her gender. That's her own doing, not sex, her gender. She was rejected despite a strong recommendation from Albert Martin Sachs, who was a professor and later dean of Harvard Law School. From 1961 to 1963, Ginsburg was a research associate and then associate director of the Columbia Law School Project in international procedure. She learned Swedish to co-author a book with Anders Berzelius on civil procedure in Sweden. Well, that's interesting. So Ginsburg conducted extensive research of her book at Lund University in Sweden. Ginsburg's time in Sweden also influenced her thinking on gender equality. She was inspired when she observed the changes in Sweden, where women were 20 to 25% of all law students. One of the judges whom Ginsburg watched for her research was 8 months pregnant and still working. In 1970, she co-founded the Women's Rights Law Reporter, the first law journal in the U.S. to focus exclusively on women's rights. From 1972 to 1980, she taught at Columbia, where she became the first tenured woman and co-authored the first law school casebook on sex discrimination. She spent a year as a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in Behavioral Science at Stanford University in 1977 and 1978. That's interesting. Behavioral science, so mind control, I guess. In 1972, Ginsburg co-founded the Women's Rights Project at the American Civil Liberties Union. And in 1973, she became the ACLU's general counsel. The Women's Rights Project and related ACLU projects participated in over 300 gender discrimination cases by 1974. The laws Ginsburg targeted included those that on the surface appeared beneficial to women, but in fact reinforced the notion that women needed to be dependent on men. Her strategic advocacy extended to the word choice, favoring the use of gender instead of sex, after her secretary suggested the word sex would serve as a distraction to judges. Let's see. Fast forward here. I guess one of her major cases was Weinberger versus Weisenfeld. 1975, Ginsburg represented a widower denied survival benefits under Social Security, which permitted widows but not widowers to collect special benefits while caring for minor children. She argued that the statute discriminated against male survivors of workers by denying them the same protection as her female counterparts. Ginsburg filed an amicus brief and sat with counsel at the oral arguments for Craig v. Boren, 1976, which challenged Oklahoma state statute that set different minimum drinking ages for men and women. For the first time, the court imposed what is known as intermediate scrutiny on laws discriminating based on gender as a heightened standard of constitutional review. Legal scholars and advocates credit Ginsburg's body of work with making significant legal advances for women under the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. Read judicial activism, really. Taken together, Ginsburg's legal victories discouraged legislatures from treating women and men differently under the law. The state continued to force. I'm sorry. The state she continued to work on the ACLU's Women's Rights Project until her appointment to the federal bench in 1980. Later, colleague Antonin Scalia praised Ginsburg's skills as an advocate. She became the leading and very successful litigator on behalf of women's rights, the Thurgood Marshall of that cause, so to speak. So I don't know if that's a compliment or not, given Thurgood Marshall's competency. But anyway, he's. Sacred in the progressive world. Ginsburg was nominated by the president. Already got that. Let's see. 1993. Of course, on the Supreme Court, 1993. And of course, that's kind of her career. We can talk about her advocacy of abortion and anti-discrimination laws as we critique her career. But that's kind of her career, her rise to the Supreme Court, and we get an idea of her advocacy of women's rights, advocating equality in the law, and I guess arguing that somehow the Equal Protection Clause in the Constitution. Required that. Of course, that's sort of a modern interpretation. So, and a problematic interpretation, really, if you really think about it, provide, you know, some analysis or some critical thought to that, because it's very problematic in terms of law and also culture and also human nature. So, Joe, that's kind of her career. So that's Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So we got a flavor of where she came from and her outlook on life. So what do you have to say?
Well, they are making her into a hero. You know, not just the fact that there's two movies, but how, you know, basically she is portrayed in the movies. I mean, so you have someone who is 100% supposedly in favor of reproductive rights, which, as far as I can tell, just means the right not to have any offspring. You know, they're making her into a hero. And so I think the question is, well, when did this process start? And I would say it started a long time ago. I think that she was, you know, she's basically a lifetime actor. And I would question, you know, some of the details of her life. I think they are fake. I listened to a couple of speeches by her. One of them was earlier in her career, and the other was much later. And the purpose of the two speeches was to show that someone had noticed that she had picked up a very strong New York accent, that the earlier speaking voice didn't have this, but later on she has like a stronger, you know, kind of a street New York accent. And this is, you know, parallel with Bill Clinton, who at one point didn't have a Southern accent, and then as he became president, you know, he became more and more kind of a hayseed Southern kind of guy. And I think that these are attributes just to create a kind of humanity, you know, for the character. And I think that with the first thing with Ginsburg is that, you know, she was top in her class. She was number one in her class, very famously at Harvard. And then she was on the law review, which I think, I'm not sure what the percentile is, but it's for the very top students at both Harvard and Columbia. She was the first person to do that. Amazing, you know, a woman beyond not just one law review, but two. And when I was listening to the speeches, I was, you know, I was thinking that, you know, it's really quite possible to get a sense of a person's sort of brain power listening to them speak. And these were long excerpts, several minutes, you know, so you could kind of like listen to it. And in my opinion, you know, she has more than a middling intelligence. But the idea of her being, you know, number one in the class at Harvard Law is just preposterous. This is like John Kerry and the Swift Boats. In other words, they would just have created these elements because they knew later on that this person was going to be valuable somehow, and that this kind of a background made them more unassailable, right? Their power as a lifetime actor, their power to dominate, you know, because of this enormous intelligence.
Yeah, these are legends, I guess, that are created, yeah.
Yeah, this is exactly. But I'm afraid that anyone is familiar with Harvard Law Review types, and I actually know someone who was on it. I won't mention it. It is a friend of mine. These are like some of the most brilliant people mm-hmm. you can imagine. Their way with words is just extraordinary. Their ability to talk is just, you know, they are obviously very high-powered mental people, unless they're fake. I think a lot of them are. I mean, Barack Obama was on the Law Review. So,
yeah, yet there's no record. There's no record. He's not.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you can't find the record. Don't ask for that. But anyway, so the point is that, you know, I think that she's a lifetime actor going very deep. And, you know, it's funny. Like, a lot of people say, well, you know, she's actually a cultural Marxist and kind of comes from Saul Alinsky school, you know, the sort of dirty tricks of cultural Marxism.
Yeah, the politics of bad faith.
Yeah, and it's true. I mean, she was appointed by the Clintons, so, you know, that's kind of a marker, an indicator, you know, that she is one of, you know, in this sort of clique. But I really think she comes from a different lineage. And the justice that she most references in the past as kind of being an idol is Felix Frankfurter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is really kind of the world that Ruth Ginsburg comes from. I'll explain why. So Frankfurter, you know, was like a Jewish cultural Marxist Supreme Court justice. He's the one who basically worked to overthrow legal local control over school boards, right, so that, you know, you could keep, you know, that your ethnicity basically as a component of the public school. And he said no, and that the integration had to occur with all deliberate speed. That was his phrase. So this was, you know, he's like a left-wing integrationist. But, and I'm not sure you're aware of this, Tim, but, you know, he was also the member of a secret society. Did you know that?
No, which society would that be?
Yeah. Well, there was a secret society that got outed, actually, by a Jewish journalist. And she found out that Felix had sworn on an oath, and she actually produced the oath, which I had sent to myself in an email so I could read it tonight. But unfortunately, since I'm in San Francisco, no technology works. We're like in the third world here. But I didn't get it. So anyway, I will just paraphrase. And basically, Felix had belonged to a secret society that the individual swore a kind of oath to the establishment of the State of Israel.
Is this Parushim?
Yeah, I think it is.
Oh, because his mentor, Brandeis, also was a member of...
Yes, that's right. Exactly. You again, as always, you tend to know more than I do, if, even after I do all the research. But the point is that so he was in this society, and the oath was, frankly, kind of frightening. I saw the thing, and my point is that it seems to violate the principle of objectivity that a Supreme Court justice must have, right? Mm-hmm. And it's amazing that this wasn't disclosed by Frankfurter during the hearings. I mean, we're having the Kavanaugh thing now, which is kind of why it was wondering why it's sort of topical. But it wasn't disclosed. It is basically putting the creation, the oath, which I don't have to read, but is available for all of our listeners online, I'm sure. It kind of just puts the creation of the State of Israel ahead of everything else. And this, if you're going to be in this group, you just have to create this bond, right? And so this was Felix Frankfurter, you know, cultural Marxist guy, big integrationist, breaking up the ethnic component of the public school system. And this is the person that, that Ruth Ginsburg relates to. This is who she says was her inspiration. And, you know, she says, you know, she says a couple times, I'm kind of following in his footsteps. And I think that she's actually quite right, because one of the big criticism, or at least a criticism, that has come out about the notorious, what is it,
RBG?
I think, yes, the notorious, yeah. Because notice she's they're heroizing
a, she's a rap star.
Yeah, like a rap star, right? So she's this, this heroic character fighting, you know, for women's rights and minority rights. Right? Mm-hmm. She's fighting for them. Well, this one woman who is a journalist wrote a, an article called, Ruth Bader Ginsburg PEP, P-E-P. And the PEP stands for Progressive Except Palestinians. And that article pointed out that, well, Ruth was not only aligned with this Frankfurter guy who was a 100% Zionist, but when she was in Israel, she basically never mentioned anything about the plight of the Palestinians. And the woman, I think the woman who wrote the article, and again, I had it all, had it, Tim, but I'm in a non-technological area, so I'm going to have to wing it with the extemporaneous talk here. The woman said, you know, she goes, it's really odd because Ruth is so in favor of the rights of the dark-skinned people. She just loves them. She just really wants to promote them, and she wants to promote integration and, of course, women's rights, but not so much for the Palestinians. She had all these opportunities to do so, and she never did it.
Perhaps they're not dark enough?
I guess they're not black enough. Yeah, it's a shame, you know, because they were close, but they didn't quite make it to Ginsburg zone of protection.
You don't rate anyway, it, you don't rate for protection if you're swarthy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So when, and this woman pointed out that she goes, well, you know, it was really odd when Ruth was in Israel. Instead of talking about maybe a little bit about the problems of the Palestinians, she said that she really affirmed the fact that she was a proponent of Jewish values. That they, in fact, she said, and again, these are all quotes from the article, which are, is online, people can get it. You know, she said, you know, I was really inspired by my religion. She left Judaism, she says, but she was, nevertheless, it's kind of her bedrock. It's what inspired her because of the charity. And also she says, you know, she says, just as an example, in my office, she has, one of those, I would just butcher the Hebrew word. It's one of these little silver scroll things. And on it, she has a line from Deuteronomy. And, they're just these three words basically, which are, it's K-E-K, I believe. And this is like, so basically you can translate these words as justice, and the English translation that many people give to it is, you know, follow justice and justice alone. And okay, so it's Deuteronomy 16, and this is what she has in her office. Now, you know, that looks pretty good. Though people, I'll go into it in a second, it's like, it's in the Kabbalistic world, that expression has another meaning than justice. It actually means Messiah. It's like bring forth the Messiah, because like this word is, would be like Melchizedek, the, you know, the righteous Messiah. It's like in the Dead Sea Scrolls, you get this word used to basically indicate the Messiah. And of course there in the Dead Sea Scrolls, you have the Messiah as a world ruler. They say the, you know, the world, the heaven and earth will obey his Messiah, world ruler. So this isn't so promising for everybody else, but it's how that the Kabbalistic people kind of look at this expression. But anyway, so Ginsburg has this there. And you know what's funny, Tim, is that it's from Deuteronomy 16. And she has that expression but she doesn't have the rest of the line, which is odd, you know, because, you know, it's a really powerful line in terms of the Jewish religion. The whole expression would read as follows. It says, follow justice and justice alone, so that you may live and possess the land the Lord your God is giving you. In other words, this expression is the 100% declaration of Zionism. It's not in any way possible to separate the first part of the expression from the second part, and particularly from someone, you know, I mean, that, you know, who is a follower of a Frankfurter who's in the secret society Zionist organizations. Now, you may wonder about, you know, well, what land are they talking about? Well, this is Deuteronomy, dude. I mean, this is where you get the description of Israel from the rivers of Egypt to the Euphrates, and they don't really give an eastern boundary. That could just be the Pacific Ocean or someplace. You know, you don't really know. So it's a big area, but this is what they get. Now, Ginsburg talk about. She was inspired, you know, by the Jewish religion, and yet she's quoting from Deuteronomy. And I thought, Tim, I would just, you know, give like an example of like, well, what does she actually mean by this religion? What is actually going on? Because a lot of times, I mean, I know not in your case, but many people, Gentiles, don't really spend much time with the Old Testament. And so I thought I would kind of bring them up to speed by just, you know, this is on the very next page from her line, which is a declaration of the, you must follow justice, or whatever the word means, to bring about the possession of the ownership of the state of Israel. Okay, so in Deuteronomy, in 20, you have directions from God. God is talking to them, and he says that when you march up to attack a city, this is Deuteronomy 20, 20. It says, when you march up to attack a city, make its people an offer of peace. Well, that looks, we're looking pretty good so far, you know, justice, mercy. Next line, it goes, if they accept and open their gates, all the people in it shall be subject to forced labor and shall work for you. Well, that doesn't sound too much like mercy to me. However, if they refuse to make peace and they engage you in battle, lay siege to the city. When the Lord your God delivers it into your hands, put to the sword all the men in it. As for the women and children, the livestock and everything else in the city, you may take these for your plunder. So that doesn't, I mean, that's kind of bad, you know. I mean, not much mercy there as far as I can tell. But it gets worse, see, because what he was talking about there was basically operations outside of that land, right, of the land God gave him. Because later on, Deuteronomy 20:16, they talk about, however, in the cities of the nations the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, do not leave alive anything that breathes. Completely destroy them. The Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded you. Now, you see, this is bad because that collection of ethnicities is not exactly able to be defined. It's very broad. Who the heck knows what it means? It just means, and you see, this is why you have the problem of progressive except Palestinians, okay, in my opinion, is that, see, the Palestinians would definitely be inside that, you know, they just wipe them out to the last person. This is right there in Deuteronomy. You actually have language that's even worse than this if you go to the Dead Sea Scrolls, because there you have like the war scroll where you basically have the entire Gentile people, you know, put to the sword at the conclusion of it. And my point is this. Okay, people say, well, these are folkloric aspects, you know, don't really mean much. Well, it's sort of the same question that comes up with Ginsburg, where, you know, you talk about, like, well, what happened to the Palestinians? I mean, she loves all these dark-skinned guys over here, that the Palestinians don't really get much. So where in Ginsburg's expression, and in the expression just in Judaism in general, is there a rejection of Deuteronomy? Because it couldn't be more racist, and it couldn't be more genocidal. And the problem is, when you look at, basically, going back to the book that I referenced in another show, The Expulsion of the Palestinians, remember that? Nir Masala's book, where he has the letters of the Zionists before the acquisition of Judea. Mm-hmm. He has the letters that were exchanged in the end of the 19th, beginning of the early century, between Golda Meir, Menachem Begin, David Ben-Gurion, a whole collection of the leaders of the Zionist movement, who eventually became the prime ministers of the State of Israel. And the question was that they went through the letter exchange was they talked about the violence needed to move the Palestinians out. What would be needed to get them out of the State of Israel that they were going to set up as a religious and exclusively Jewish state. Okay, that's absolutely clear cut. That's in their documentation. And so they asked one another, does anyone here basically have any moral question about using violence to get these guys out? And I'm sure the reason they did that is because they wanted to know now. In other words, you wonder, well, why are they even having this question brought up? It's because they wanted to be absolutely certain that everyone who was going to be in a position of authority was on the same page in regards to this, because they didn't want someone going merciful and exposing basically the activity, right, the violent mm-hmm. activity, because they were going to try to camouflage it to the world. They wanted to make sure that no one would basically blow the whistle. And so that's why they had, in many of the letters, they have this question, do you have any moral issue with it? And the answer is always, no, don't have a moral issue. So my point is this, is that when you look at Ginsburg, Ruth Bader, and you see her with this little cryptic line from Deuteronomy 16 about, you know, justice, justice, follow justice, but then she doesn't mention that what that actually is referring to is to the creation of the State of Israel. Follow justice and justice alone, so that you may live and possess the land the Lord your God has given you. Okay, so that's the full line. She has the first, you know, part of it, and then keeps the second part. You know, again, it's if they put the stuff in plain sight, the expectation is that no one really is going to call them on it. This way she can make representation because, you know, imagine in Israel when you use the first part of Deuteronomy 16 about, you know, follow justice and justice alone. I mean, you think those people wouldn't know what she's talking about? They would not understand that that line is a specific reference to basically the justice, which is the vengeance on all of these ethnicities to possess the land that, you know, is being established. So this is how I see her, Tim. Sorry to be long-winded, but, you know, I see her plugged in basically to this strand that comes forward from Felix Frankfurter, the secret society, which was basically oath takers to just put nothing, you know, ahead of the establishment of the State of Israel. When you look at Ginsburg and you see the progressive activity, what you're seeing is basically justice, because she feels that there is justice in the destruction of the Gentile ethnicities, right? And so obviously these progressive policies, these anti-family, you know, pro-abortion, pro-forced integration, all of these things would make sense to her in that regard, in terms of justice based on the first century, which I think is where her perspective is, you know, vengeance. And then Zionism. And then now suddenly she makes perfect sense. I mean, before this interpretation is given to her, there's this big question mark about, well, she never says anything about Palestinians. How come? And the lady who wrote the article, P.E.P., Pep, you know, she was wondering. And I think basically, you know, if you look, you know, hard enough, you can see the answer.
Yeah. First thing is you do have an issue of these of American Jews having a loyalty or a devotion to Israel, which is a foreign state. And so the question of due loyalty or just loyalty comes up when these people are entrusted with a powerful office of state. This is a problem that goes back even before the founding of Israel. One is, you mentioned Frankfurter, and of course his mentor was Louis Brandeis, who was the first Jew appointed to the Supreme Court, I think, by Woodrow Wilson back in, yep. I think, around 1915 or 16, if I have that right. And there was a question of some suspicion because he was Jewish, and that has since been written off as just prejudice, anti-Semitism, bigotry, and these things. But lo and behold, we find that he did indeed belong to a secret society, something that he said he had renounced when he was entrusted with being a member of the Supreme Court. And he worked behind the scenes to fulfill the Zionist project, using the vessel of America to help, as did many Jews in America in the First World War period and the Second World War, in finance and government and these things. So it lo and behold, it does become a legitimate question if they indeed consider themselves a member of a tribe who have some loyalty to this entity called Israel. And so it does become a legitimate question, especially when it's been exposed that these Felix Frankfurter and Louis Brandeis celebrated Jewish members of the Supreme Court who belonged to a secret society with a secret oath, which would contradict their oath to the United States and to the became Supreme Court justices, or they became judges, I imagine. So that's a legitimate problem that we see. I think many people have commented about that with the infiltration of the U.S. government by Israeli interests. And I think Phil Giraldi made this case. Unfortunately, this raises the suspicion of any Jew in government or in power, whether they can be trusted. And this is something they've really pretty much brought on themselves, because they out and out say it. They'll say that their job is to support Israel and support Jewish power and these things, and they shouldn't be shy about it. Alan Dershowitz has said these things too. So it's, you know, when they say it's progressive to have Jews in the Supreme Court, well, okay, that's fine. But the problem with that is, lo and behold, they're always going to be working on some secret agenda. And not so secret agenda, because it's kind of like hiding in plain sight in many cases. But you make a good point about her activism, her years of litigating and advocating so-called women's rights and individual rights and these things. These things sound nice, like liberty, fraternity, and equality. Sounds very nice, but if you really apply some critical thought to it, they actually contradict one another. But it sounds nice. It's like land, bread, and peace, or hope, you know, these slogans. Yeah. It's a bit, but things are a bit more complicated than that. And you have to be a bit more sophisticated in your analysis of what's really laying behind this advocacy. You and I both talked about, and I've done other interviews with other people talking about how a lot of the Jewish support for progressive causes is a cover for promoting sort of a pluralistic and therefore atomized society, weakening the host society, so they can don't have to deal with any other strong ethnic competing interests. Like, they are the only ones who can identify as a strong ethnic group, but the majority ethnic group, as in, you know, the white America, ethno-whites can't. That's illegitimate for ethno-whites to think in terms of ethnicity, but it's okay for Jews to think in terms of ethnicity. And they've used things like integration, desegregation, individual rights, women's rights, progress, and, you know, how you see it in this movie that's coming out with on the basis of sex, as if the law shouldn't have any distinction on the basis of sex, when that's the most profound distinction there is when it comes to to all creatures, but to people specifically. What it does is it suggests that there are no legitimate distinctions, when indeed we both know there are. So we can apply this critique to her activism. This is, I think, perhaps some of these stories of her being discriminated against when she was young is a legend created that would legitimize that she herself was a victim and sort of spurred her on to fight for justice as she saw it, of course. But if you look at it, all her activism, whether it's for women's rights. Now, what are women's rights? It's like things like privacy. Well, Turns out women's right to privacy is there to defend infanticide, the killing of unborn children, the offspring of these women. And so she uses these terms, euphemisms, never really directs the question, like women should have the right to kill their unborn child. She says just the right to privacy, which is a problematic legal doctrine that was created out of whole cloth by an activist Supreme Court, which wanted to see abortion legalized across the land, regardless of what the Constitution did not say. And so it's bad faith on their part, on her part. She has stated that abortion, she believes it's a matter of privacy, but then again, she is an advocate of taxpayer-funded abortion. Contradiction. Because the moment you invite taxpayer, you violate privacy. You're no longer private. It's no longer a private matter. So all her activism is very, you know, even the idea of women's rights and employment, all this sounds very progressive and fair, because you know, we now live in a society where culturally it's been shifted to, it's just presumed that women seek gainful employment outside the home full time, which begs the question, if most women are doing this, who is taking care of Junior? Who's taking care of the children? Well, Ruth Bader Ginsburg has a solution to that, because she's a strong advocate of comprehensive government-provided child care. So she's advocating the destruction of the traditional nuclear family. So then she's signaling the American the AJC's objective in the authoritarian personality. She's gone after ideas of, she said in 1977. Now this is before she was appointed run nominee to the Supreme Court, even to the judiciary, and it should have come up in when she was being appointed. Yet there is an agenda behind this stuff, because these, again, her rise to the judiciary, I don't think is just based on her merit or accidental or coincidental. I think there's an agenda being pushed here, and we've done studies how the oligarchs were pushing this agenda decades before. But in 1977, this is, if I do my math, 16 years before she was appointed to the Supreme Court, she wrote a book. I believe it was called, where's my notes here? Sorry. Sex. Here we go. Found my notes. Fortunately, I can't find the title. Sex Bias in the U.S. Code, 1977. Basically, it was a study on how the law would be changed when ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, was passed. It was considered a foregone conclusion at the time. Of course, ERA was stopped in its tracks by the activism, mostly by Phyllis Schlafly in 1977, by pointing out what the effects of the Equal Rights Amendment would be on law and society. But in that book, she suggested that we need to do away with the concept of breadwinner, father, and the wife in the home as the caregiver, and the role of father, distinct from mother, should be excised from the law. And it was this type of advocacy, and she also which stopped ERA, because people became cognizant of the fact that this wasn't just a slogan. Equal rights sounds so nice. People realize this is the level of thinking, even as late as the 1970s, so much better than it is today. You couldn't just sell someone on a bumper sticker slogan. There are some profound implications if ERA was passed. One would be women in the military, women in combat. One would be the destruction of single-sex education institutions and these things. And so it was stopped. So she's advocating all these institutions, advocating laws that will weaken family, that will weaken. When she says she supports advocacy that women become independent. Independent from what? Okay, you can say they become atomized. Other than in this, pick another word, atomized. Depends how you interpret it. So if men and women no longer need each other, okay, you're going to have people not forming families or getting divorced or higher rates of divorce. And we all know how this was promoted in the 60s and 70s with no-fault divorce and also the cult. We haven't gotten into the culture agenda that's being promoted by the Jews that control Hollywood and the culture industry. So there's a legal agenda being pursued. At the same time, there's a cultural agenda being pursued, and both are supporting one another. And they're both dominated by members of this particular ethno-religious group, which is suspect, to say the least.
So. Yeah, and I mean, and remember that when you, and I think you're absolutely right to link her to the American Jewish Committee as the authoritarian personality, which is, you know, basically a declaration of ethnic warfare using pseudo-psychological and pseudo-sociological science, right? They talk about, and they're very clear about, they're going to use propaganda, which is just basically mind control, to implement sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And so with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, on one hand, you have just the evaporation, you know, she wants the legal evaporation of all of the distinctions between men and women. In other words, their sexuality is basically irrelevant and is not a function that can be, you know, brought into a legal context. And of course, the idea is, going back to the authoritarian personality, is that there is no father, right? Mm-hmm. The father is because, you know, the family is gone. They're just individuals. Their sexuality is question mark. And then the final touch, and what really I think should help people understand Ginsburg, is that she also advocated that the age of consent for sexual acts that could be prosecutable be lowered to 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And again, this is not, I mean, it, you know, people may think, oh, that's just ridiculous. No, this is fact. She actually advocated it. And so when you combine all of these elements and then compare them to the authoritarian personality vision, you can see the relationship. I mean, these are not the relationships between Ginsburg's legal advocacy and the pseudo-psychological advocacy of the American Jewish Committee's authoritarian personality. Tim, they're the same thing.
And the law is and the law has essentially been weaponized because
it's been weaponized. Yeah, exactly. It's been weaponized, and so you're looking at a lot of different forces that are demolishing European culture. You've got Hollywood, with pornography, and also with basically weaponized integration and weaponized feminism. Right, this is all coming at you in all of the media, both the news and the films and whatnot are obviously all of these trend-setting. With transgender, with where we are today, of course, you know, had this long process that's sad but very clear.
And we're looking at something like pornography, and we're laying the blame at the foot of primarily Jews. Well, that's actually, you know, there is a academic book written by, I think, called guy named Gertzman, whose uncle back in the 50s was arrested for distributing pornography, but he wrote a book, I think it's called Smut Hounds and Booklegers, or Booklegers and Smut Hounds. And it credits the Jews for legitimizing and spreading pornography. This is another case of where they take credit for it if they see it as progressive, if they see it as Tikkun Olam repairing the world. But if you take a critical look at it and blame them for it, then you're anti-Semitic. But that's the Jewish role in things like abortion and pornography is undeniable.
Yeah, and so... So when we look at Ginsburg being, you know, made a hero, I don't think you're going to find connections to her to Freemasonry or, you know, to B'nai B'rith or even to Saul Alinsky. I looked to see if there was, and I think that's a different strand.
Mm-hmm.
I think that she was prepared to be clean. In other words, to not have those kinds of visible connections that could be exposed and then keep her from being a heroine. And I think that what is going on now is the manifestation of a very long plan to use her personality that is artificial, right, to create a situation now where the hero is someone who is basically leading women against all of this injustice, right? This is how she's set up. She's, you know, they've got a clever rap nickname for her. They have very attractive actresses playing her young, and then they have these melodramatic situations set up where, you know, Ginsburg is literally fighting against, well, Donald Trump. And notice that the juxtaposition, because I don't think this is circumstance either. I mean, these things are coming out during the Kavanaugh-Trump situation, right? And so you can see how we're being manipulated on both sides. You have Kavanaugh bringing to mind the very worst kinds of male behavior. I mean, these are his actions as are being asserted, right? Are the, you know, just this monstrous sexual predator. And at the same time, you've got this, you know, petite and pretty Jewish attorney fighting to keep women, safe from this guy. So I think that in terms of how they're manipulating the unconscious, in terms of the neurolinguistic programming, I think Bader is basically the juxtaposition to Kavanaugh. And I think both of them are...
She's silent about Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
Right? I mean...
Yeah, nothing there. And nothing... Yeah.
The guy who appointed her. Okay, so...
Yeah. And it's just... you know, the thing that always amazes me is it's like, you know, she's there in Israel. I mean, they've got the settlements. I mean, what do you think the... integration with all deliberate speed of those school districts is going on. How is that coming along? A single Palestinian? Zero? Oh my gosh. Well, I guess they're special. You know, I guess they just can have their own little special segregated and racial and religiously separate and ethnically separate zone. And all the rest of the world, well, there's Ruth Ginsburg, the smiling face of forced weaponized integration.
Well, yeah, she may not believe in God, but she still believes she's chosen. So,
yeah, chosen. You know, so anyway, I think of her, you know, just an obvious lifetime actor. I think, you know, it's like I look at like Martin Luther King's PhD. I think her, you know, number one at Harvard Law School Review and Harvard and Columbia Law School Review. I think this is just how she was established to be. You know, able to be put on the Supreme Court and that she would have these intellectual attributes. She doesn't really seem very smart to me and of course now she's basically brain dead, but when she was younger even, I mean, I've listened to, I've had some of her, you know, speeches and things from when she was, I think in the 40s or in her 50s. And I don't know, I just don't see it. I would like to, like, you know, I'd like to better myself, but I don't think I'll get a chance to. But anyway, I think it's just far more likely that all of these things are just the attributes of a lifetime actor these are theatrical props. And so now we get these movies that are coming out at the same time. You have the Kavanaugh debacle and we're supposed to realize that, well, the heterosexual era is over. The Kavanaugh males are going to be done away with, and there's going to be a progressive world, a world of peace, tranquility, and single moms, and families without males.
Yeah,
it's
interesting because the Kavanaugh, there's some good questions regarding his role in the Bush administration in the illegal surveillance and these things. And
well, writing the Patriot Act.
Yeah, involvement. You know, I mean, no one's talking about that, but that wouldn't.
Right.
Support, because the agenda is to carry on with the Patriot Act. And so, you know, they'd rather have this sort of manufactured issue as opposed to the real concerns.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, of course, we're getting fun in both directions. We don't get to analyze Kavanaugh as a traitor for having helped produce the Patriot Act.
Yeah, yeah.
But we do get to have him spun as, you know, perhaps unfairly accused white male sexual abuser. By all of these progressives who are coming out of the closet only after the nomination occurred to create the most, you know, the most intense drama imaginable. So what I see is it's just like when I saw Trump and Hillary nominated, mm-hmm. I said, look, these are puppets and we are supposed to root for one or the other. They are deliberate constructions to try to make people hate one or the other.
Yes, yeah.
But the point of the drama, the whole point, is so that we don't see the strings.
Mm-hmm.
When you have, you know, Kavanaugh, now struggling with the nomination, at the same time you've got the notorious RBG movies in place, the public is just being spun. You know, we're we root for one or the other. And what we don't see is that there really isn't any distinction in terms of the control of both of these individuals. The Federal Reserve will continue to control credit and give the ill-gotten gains to the families and ethnicity mm-hmm. that own it. And the wars will continue unabated. The Supreme Court will not step in and restrain the president from illegally using our military in this way. These things won't These things will not be addressed. Now, same-sex marriage, yes, that will be an enormous puppet show.
Yes.
Drama everywhere and same-sex bathrooms. And Tim, do you mind if I digress just for 1 second and tell a little story what happened to me yesterday?
Certainly, go ahead.
Well, you know, I'm in San Francisco. and here anything can happen. And so
Joe, don't walk around don't walk around with your shirt off in San Francisco.
Yeah, I would. But that's the second part of the story. But
okay.
So the first part of the story is I was what street I was on?
Castro?
Market Street.
Okay.
That was later. I was on Market Street and a huge demonstration came marching down. It had full police protection. They had, 20 cop cars and police, and they had a marching band, and they had people with placards, you know, and there were hundreds of them. And the huge poster that they were carrying at the front of it read, "Cancel Kavanaugh."
Hmm.
And so I was then basically on the street, and I was curious, and I went up and I was talking to people, and you know who was promoting it was the Socialist Organization of America. That was the promoter of the Cancel Kavanaugh display that somehow has been able to get 20 police cars. Now, I thought, you know, nothing much of it. I thought, well, I'm at least glad to see some political activity from people. They were polite, you know,
mm-hmm.
not any kind of a big deal. Later in another part of the town, we came across another parade, which was what's called a pride parade. And there was a name for it, and I forget. I had it written down. Everything is done. But it was a pride parade. And in this parade, it's basically promoting the fun homosexual lifestyle. I mean, this is, you know, something traditional here in San Francisco. And it was actually larger than the Cancel Kavanaugh. There was like maybe 500 people. But you know what was interesting and was that there was a lot of naked genitalia in the parade.
Hmm.
And I mean, you know, this was like down a public street and no one was arrested. It was just, you know, and there was also effigies. There was like phallic dolls and things, you know.
Proud of this?
Well, yeah, it's called Pride, and
I think it's about time for a shame parade.
Yeah, I would have had the shame parade anyway. my thing was is I was there with someone, and I said, you know, even Sodom and Gomorrah, there was politeness. You know, I mean, we have really got to the bottom of the barrel here. This is this is pretty grim. So. San Francisco culturally, I'm not sure how they are going to come up out of it. But the reason that I, you know, have these kind of poignant thoughts and even brought up these little stories is that these are all related, honestly, to the sum total of the group and the organization that Ruth Ginsburg played a role in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is really no. You know, it's all part and parcel of the same thing. And here we are. People can now see where we're going to, you know, what we have become. And so I hope that this would create some energy in the listening public that need to organize and try to find ways to resist because they are well organized. When you look at Ginsburg, and think of her as a lifetime actor and think about, you know, it's like, Gloria Steinem getting the Chester Bull scholarship, you know, and she's in college, you know, where, in other words.
Where's the movie about Phyllis Schlafly?
Yeah, where is the movie about that?
I think that's more of a stunning story because Phyllis Schlafly went against the zeitgeist, didn't have corporate government backing. I mean, it really
was a lifetime actor.
You know, yeah, genuine grassroots. Yet no movie.
Yeah, absolutely, and exactly. And like, where's the movie you think in Hollywood supposedly, you know, which has creativity, ambitiousness, mischievousness? These are the things that they kind of claim. Where is a movie exposing the possible dark side of Notorious Ginsburg?
Yeah, her promotion of pedophilia, the legal promotion, and connection to gay rights, Harry Hay and NAMBLA and these things. There's no, they don't want to talk about that, you know, or the fact that she actually said that her advocacy of abortion was largely related to her fear of population. Overpopulation, and therefore it's eugenics, and so it's not about love and privacy. It's about reducing numbers of less desirable people in her mind.
Exactly.
That's progressive.
And that's very progressive. And then when you look at the lack of support for the Palestinians, you can see that it's very consistent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people who are in the thrall of Ginsburg and think that she's a heroine, they should really ask the question, a serious question about her relationship to the Palestinians, because this is, to me, this is the easiest, you know, kind of marker giveaway, you know, that you can, that's the exposed moment, you know, where you can really see, you know, what her words actually mean, you know, and who she really is, because they're the ones who, are basically, they are what we will be. You know, we have to look at the Palestinians as our future.
Well, so she'll use groups like the Palestinians to shatter European societies, you know, promote wars, you know, so they can create a refugee crisis and flood. Interesting enough, a country like Sweden, right, which she took notice of, interest of back in the 1970s about promoting cultural Marxism in that country and sort of, undermining or demoralizing that country so it could be set up to face what's facing today, which is, being demographically wiped out.
Genocide. Yeah, they're going to zero. And so it was, it could not possibly be circumvent. This is all well organized. They're trying to take these populations to zero. This has been obviously, it is part and parcel. It's like when I was reading Deuteronomy, right? It's that old. This is their perspective. If they didn't feel this way in their heart and in their activity, they would be talking about Deuteronomy as something that was incorrect, that needs, you know, that is wrong, and they would be applying the error of it to manifest some charity toward the Palestinians. Nothing, right? Nothing. The genocide just goes on every day. No one says a word from this collection, and it's because, frankly, they're more aligned with Deuteronomy than they are with any kind of, progressive flowery language. I mean, Deuteronomy is what is basically in back of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and that's why she has it, on her wall in her office.
Yeah,
you know.
And there's one thing I want to, her jurisprudence, and this is jurisprudence, or this idea of being a liberal activist judge, a progressive judge in these things, is very problematic from the standpoint of constitutional law, because, you know, we all understand that ostensibly the function of a judge is to interpret the law based on the reading of the law, and you have to have what they call judicial temperament, meaning that you shouldn't let your personal preferences or ambitions reflect in your decisions or shape your decisions as the law. And well, we all know that that's not the case. That's not what judges do now. It's openly talked to judges. The judiciary is supposed to be used as a tool for reform or a positive reform or change in society that stubbornly won't change. And this is kind of like goes back to Meyerdahl's book, The American Dilemma, which said that America was irredeemably racist, and you needed an activist court to sort of hammer through change. And of course, that simply wasn't the case. But this also was an agenda behind it, because again, this idea that the forces of integration were used to itemize society and these things. But some of these recent cases, for whom is she working when she renders these decisions? One would be, of course, you have back in, I think, the 90s, you had the VMI case, Virginia Military Institute, which was ordered to open up to women. And, of course, the basis of this was the 14th Amendment. The problem with the 14th Amendment, which, of course, that was passed in 1866, I believe, right after the Civil War, is that if indeed the people who passed the 14th Amendment meant that it would require all single taxpayers supported at the state and federal level to allow the admission of women, it was clearly not in the minds of the men who wrote the 14th Amendment. So this was a modern interpretation or distortion to achieve a contemporary or modern political agenda, which is the integration of these schools with women. So this really wasn't a matter of fundamental law. It was the idea of Virginia Military Institute. Same with the Citadel. The people of the state of North Carolina and the people of the state of Virginia, respectively, simply wanted to maintain these institutions as all-male, single-sex military academies. Yet she hammers it open, you know, she uses the law, the 14th Amendment, and four of the justices agree, I suppose, I forget what the how it broke down in that case, is that somehow the 14th Amendment means this. Well, obviously it doesn't, because when it was passed, no one intended that to mean that you'd had to desegregate or integrate all male institutions. It's absurd. So it's a bad faith interpretation of the law. It's obvious. Same thing with, basically with school desegregation. This is a policy matter. It needs to be changed legislatively. And the courts are simply engaging social engineering, like in Brown versus Board of Education, these things. It was a doll test or something that decided it was about esteem and these things. It wasn't about law, the Constitution, these things. Another case would have been, of course, we have the recent Obergefell decision. This was the gay marriage ruling, meaning, again, another claiming that somehow the 14th Amendment required that all states had to accept same-sex unions. That's ridiculous. I mean, you're going to tell me that when Congress passed the 14th Amendment back in the 1860s, they were intending it to apply to allow for same-sex unions? No, and then you have because then again, with Ginsburg, she has other people, people like turncoats like Anthony Kennedy, Catholic quislings like Kennedy, who rendered this decision that says somehow that, the evolving ideas of marriage and liberty mean that we have to render the decision. Well, if that is indeed the case, then it has to be carried out legislatively, not through the judiciary. That's ridiculous. It's obvious. See, the 14th Amendment did not.
Of course.
Yeah, I mean, this is self-evident, yet we're supposed to sit back and have respect for these court decisions when they're obviously, politically driven, agenda-driven. And same thing with Obamacare, right? Blatantly unconstitutional for so many reasons, yet they hammer out a majority because the Obamacare was essential for the objective of the oligarchs, which is a slave state. You need to get people roped into the system, and the Constitution apparently stood in its way, and they just pushed it aside. A tax is a tax when it's not a tax. A longer fee, we'll call it a tax. The only problem is, if it is indeed a tax, and therefore constitutional, the bill was originated in the House. The Constitution clearly states that spending bill, any tax, has to originate in the House. This originated in the Senate. Now, I can read that and say, well, this is basically blatantly unconstitutional. I'm not a lawyer. Yet, it just seems to be ignored. It's obvious. She's in all these decisions. She's in the majority of all these horrible decisions. So she's a tool of the oligarchs. I mean, it's
absolutely. And I was just going to mention that one of the quotes that she gave, which is very revealing, is that she said that after World War II, it was clear that you couldn't trust the voters, and so in order for society to be wholesome, you needed to have the application of a higher standard. Like interpretation of the Constitution. In other words, in that statement, she actually basically just said, well, that my judicial temperament is that I don't really care what the voters say.
Yeah.
We are the arbitrator of what is real and what isn't. And the 14th Amendment, you may have thought it meant something clear, but it really doesn't. It really gives us just power to just speak about doing what we want. And so, this, again, when you talk about judicial temperament, she is never called to task for any of this. The movies that are out there lionizing her obviously won't bring any of these issues up. And, of course, she's just held as the opposite of Kavanaugh.
Right? Kavanaugh, I read a stunning quote by her. that she was critical of Roe v. Wade because it didn't give abortion the opportunity to gain popular support, making it a controversial issue.
Right, right. I know. She is just about as much a genocidist as Bill Gates is. I mean, she just really wants everyone off the planet she doesn't like. So anyway, let's hope that, you know, there'll be some people who will stand up against, you know, not just against the reality of her actions, you know, but against the fantasy of her as a fighter, you know, for trying to support women in general. You know, I don't really think that can just even hold up to any kind of scrutiny. The Palestinian women aren't being defended. And of course, you know, the idea that the single mom with the welfare state as a replacement to a husband is some kind of a support of a woman. I mean, that is not an argument that anyone is going to buy any longer. And so, you know, to hell with her. She should be exposed as someone who is instead of the notorious RBG, it should be the notorious tool of the oligarch.
Yeah, and women are liberated from their husbands to be enslaved by the welfare state or some corporation that they have to work for to make ends meet. That's really the real result of this. And again, I kind of alluded to this in the beginning, is this appeal to individualism and freedom, the atomized individual who can step into an institution, you know, full of men, and she can just ruffle feathers and turn everything upside down as if the institution itself has no rights. Just the individual. This is a trick, because the ethnicity, because really it's one of these things where on paper it sounds nice, individual rights, but really when it comes down to it, you're gonna have, as an individual, you need some backing of your family, extended family, in your community, of your parish, and these things. And these institutions are pre-political. They're not liberal. They're often very prescriptive in these things, and they can appear restricting in many cases. But they're the only thing you have to really to defend yourself against the cold embrace of the corporate state, which you stand naked before if you don't have your family. And that's what these women are discovering today. You have these careers, and a few of them may have high-powered jobs. Most of them are just working to make ends meet, working two jobs, perhaps two part-time jobs. They're lonely, have no family. They're unhappy because they're not fulfilled. They're not fulfilled because, at the end of the day, all they have are things and money, if they're lucky, but and little of that in many, many cases. But you have no purpose. And really, the reality is, at the end of the day, the only thing that matters is the people you leave behind, and that you have to have family for that. And she set up a situation where that is no longer supported by the institution. In fact, that is targeted by the education institutions, economics, and these things, and government.
Yeah, absolutely. And they talk about, you know, RBG will be there to protect you by, you know, the production of the welfare state, which of course is just a straight shoot into absolute slavery. But
That's the irony, is that these feminists come across as strong, independent women. We can do it our own. But they're the strongest advocates of like the welfare state. That's complete slavery.
It's straight shooting into slavery. And the thing is, when you look at like Jewish feminists like Ginsburg, you know, she talks about all the things that will support a woman. And of course, they're all, for some reason, things that will break up both the family and the ethnicity,
mm-hmm.
right? Because remember, if we're going to this, you know, multicultural, right? So the ethnicity, that is, even though that's never discussed or brought up as something that could support and protect someone, my question is, when you look at, like, Gloria Steinem and Ginsburg, who are often together, you know, making fist power symbols, you know, they benefit from what I would call the Jewish ethnicity, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Well, why isn't then the ability of ethnicity as something to support and defend someone ever mentioned in any of these discussions, Tim?
Well, because white ethnics don't have that privilege to acknowledge or any interests. They have to be atomized and weak because they're privileged. And so it's only the oppressed
group.
because Ginsburg goes to Israel all the time. They were going to give her this big award, and then they found out they couldn't because she was a judge. But so she goes there, and she checks all the boxes as a big-time Zionist and gets tremendous pleasure and benefit out of this ethnic enclave. And then she comes back and lectures, women as to, all of the good stuff she's done for them. But I never hear her talk about, well, your ethnicity is kind of evaporating. And that's a shame because, ethnicity can really be a powerful defensive thing and a thing that can create great meaning,
mm-hmm.
like in my life, But you don't hear that.
No. Yeah.
And I just wondered, well, why not? Why not, Tim?
Well, because their strength, our strength is diversity, and it's their strength, right?
Their strength is our diversity.
Is our diversity, because
exactly,
we're divided
yeah.
and weak and atomized, and we can't muster an argument or a thought to defend our own interests, and nor do we are able to recognize that we indeed have enemies. And of course, we're called to love our enemies, but not deny that they exist. And deal with them accordingly.
Yeah, we're caught up in the Kavanaugh, notorious RBG, puppet show, and whether or not he blacked out before he groped a woman is like something that people are paying attention to. When the simple truth, this such obvious truth that Ginsburg is enjoying and being protected and promoted by her adherence. To it, her ethnicity. Her ethnicity has tremendous benefit.
Mm-hmm.
The European ethnicities are all just being evaporated as quickly as is possible. And the fact that her ethnicity is beneficial, you would wonder why, since she's such a promoter, right, of all of the dark-skinned people and women, why she never brings up the fact, you guys should really look into maybe promoting your ethnicity. It sure works for us Jews.
Yeah,
I never hear that.
Yeah, and good example is whenever there's I believe three Jewish members of the Supreme Court now, whenever there is usually when there's a Catholic appointee, the Catholic will be questioned about their religion and what role Catholic dogma has in their thought and perhaps in their jurisprudence and how they approach the law. That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
No one ever asks a Jewish nominee, what role does the Talmud have in their interpretation?
Well, and how about let's see, Ruth, it says here that you guys are going to wipe out all these ethnicities.
Yeah.
Am I in that group?
Yeah.
I'd like to know that because if we give you basically legal control over us, this could work out really badly for us. See, so I'd really like some. When you talk about the religion as something that is merciful and an inspiration for you, please clarify Deuteronomy 20, where you wipe out all the ethnicities that happen to be anywhere near Judea, and when you leave Judea and you take over a city, if you don't surrender just immediately, you get to kill everybody and take the women and children as slaves.
Yeah, and where that part that says that all non. Jews aren't human beings,
Right.
What do you think about that? Or, ask about, Ruth, Judge Ginsburg, you're here, you're appointed to the Supreme Court. Back in 1977, you advocated, doing away with fatherhood, motherhood, and the law? That's kind of radical. Would that affect your jurisprudence? Or, you think that the age of consent should be reduced to 12? I don't think we have someone on the court who believes this stuff. That's pretty disturbing. But she was approved 97-3, despite this long paper trail of radical activism. And it just shows the special treatment she got because she's Jewish.
Yeah, exactly. It just shows, that they control it. It just shows this Masonic Jewish society runs, the so-called Congress is just a complete joke. It's an obvious artificial apparatus.
Well, most of the senators asking the questions, they probably have files of them over there in Tel Aviv about them with, either dead boy, live girl, dead girls or live boys. So Congress
those that aren't cryptos.
Yeah. And what's interesting is
lifetime actors, yeah.
She's an advocate of the Equal Rights Amendment, and she was defeated by Phyllis Schlafly through the legitimate political process, legislative process, grassroots activism, so she becomes a judge. Then she and many of her colleagues in the judiciary, in the bureaucracy, move to gradually implement the Equal Rights Amendment just through judicial activism. That's what the VMI decision was. It was basically an application of the Equal Rights Amendment. It didn't pass, and they're doing it gradually through this evolving understanding of the Constitution. One of the main reasons why ERA didn't pass in the 1970s was Phyllis Schlafly said, if you take this law as it is written and amend the Constitution with it, it could be used to justify same-sex marriage. And lo and behold, what does the court do? Years later, a few decades later, is they say it's a matter of the 14th Amendment that same-sex unions, all states have to recognize same-sex unions. To hell with the legislatures, to hell with popular will. This is what it must be done. And this complete bad faith. They quite frankly, when a judge does this, they should be impeached. That's the responsibility of the Congress, of the Senate, to oversee this, the House and Senate, to oversee these things. When they find a judge that has lacks judicial temperament, there's nothing wrong with removing him or her from the bench. And that's in the Constitution. But again, what they're doing, they've changed the culture, and this is where Ruth Gator, her allies in the culture industry, preceding her activism, they changed the culture gradually. Hollywood and Madison Avenue and these things corrupt the culture, sexualize the culture. So then they soften it up. So there's little opposition when they come down with these decisions years later. But it's all an accident, I suppose.
Just all an accident. It's just history unfolding. Culture just moves in a mysterious direction, and yes, that's why at the Pride Parade today there was probably 10 genitalia displays, and Phyllis Schlafly was just, she couldn't have been more accurate as far as, I mean, she was the Nostradamus of, like, the 21st century. She saw exactly where we're headed. The question is how to head in a better direction, because as we move now, you know, they have, they have all these biologically damaged humans. You know, yeah, they've got the sperm count so low that I'm sure that this is affecting, masculinity. It's got to be in a diminished state. They've got all the plastic memory, the toxicity. So it's really going to be tough. We have to, first of all, work on our physical health, I would say. You know, that's number one. And, you know, one thing I will say is, like, I think there's starting to be some awareness on mothers now about, you know, vaccinations mm-hmm. in the first day of life, and also, the diet they have to maintain. We're damaged every day, and so you can't make up for it completely, like, by being healthy during the pregnancy. But at least it's a step.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just noticing that women I'm talking to are becoming more and more aware. They may not be politicized, but they are very concerned. I mean, there's just so much autism,
mm-hmm.
and diminished children that, you know, mothers are worried about this. And so they're acting independently. You know, the AMA is never going to give them any facts. So anyway, so that's at least one healthy sign. And, I don't know. We'll just take it one step at a time. The most important thing is information. You know, you've got to build out the schematic. When you have something like these films heroizing Ginsburg, I mean, people who are aware, we have a responsibility. We have to, you know, make sure that we are not intimidated to enter into a discussion and say, you know, she is a whore of the oligarchs
mm-hmm.
and a member of, obviously, of either a member of or someone who is aligned with secret societies that are intent on destroying European culture and genetics. You know, this is who she is. So that's our role, Joe.
Yeah. Okay, Joe. I think that's
I think we've got a good face on it. And you know, I just wanted to apologize for my my tone. I'm in a non-technologic zone here, surrounded by the remnants of gay pride parades, and I'm just bivouacked in this room within a closet. So next week, I promise you, everything will be back to normal. But anyway, sorry for the sound.
Yeah, San Francisco is the only city where the straight people are in the closet, so.
Yeah, that's right. We're staying here, buddy. We are not coming out into the street. All right, brother.
Okay.
I'll talk to you next week.
Enjoy your weekend. Bye-bye.
All right. Good night. Bye-bye.